The latest version of the TV series Cosmos is now airing on Fox TV. So for the holidays, we're sharing our recent episode with the show's writer and producer, Anne Druyan.
Hey, Anna. Space is pretty big, right?
I've heard something about that, yeah.
I mean, it's humongous. It's, you know, there's trillions of galaxies, each with billions of stars. And here we are on this little Earth. How does it make you feel? Is space scary big?
Yeah. I mean, it's like, I literally can't comprehend how big it is. And then I like to feel like little dainty and tiny, also insignificant. But also, if you're like having a bad day, it's like, this does not matter. Like the universe plus the thousands of other universes, nobody cares.
So mixed reaction to the size and scale of things. I see. You like to be small, but also like to be big and also be important.
That's right. But sometimes it's good to give some perspective.
It's the conundrum. This is the, yeah, living in this gigantic cosmos. Where do you find your place in it? Well, I think we're going to be talking to somebody that can help us out with that.
It's going to be fun.
Cosmos. Get it? Did I throw it in there pretty good?
I think you did. It was like subtle, but also intentional.
Oh, good.
Which you really nailed.
From the various home studios and Cincinnati Public Radio, I'm Dean Regas, and this is Looking Up.
And I'm Anna Heeman, and even though we're both at home, we also work at the Cincinnati Observatory, where Dean is the astronomer, and I have a need to know the truth. In this episode, we have a wonderful conversation with Anne Druyan, who is a writer and producer for the Cosmos series and was married to Carl Sagan for many years. So before the world shut down, essentially, we had the chance, and we were so excited to talk with Anne Druyan, who's worked on Cosmos for so long. Now, Dean, are you a fan of the show?
Oh, most definitely. I mean, it was great to talk to her about this. This was right when her book came out about Cosmos and the series. And, that this kind of picked up from Carl Sagan's legacy from way back when. And then Neil deGrasse Tyson picks up the mantle and did a great job with the new version, too. So it's it was really fun to talk to her.
Yeah, I thought she had some just was an interesting interview just from somebody who worked on the show, but then also married to Carl Sagan. I mean, I thought she was just an interesting and fun person to talk to for sure. And I feel like it was forever ago that we talked to her, but it wasn't that long. It was just, now we're.
I know. And we got the two different series, basically. I mean, they're the same kind of theme, the both Cosmoses, but. People ask like, well, which one do you like better? Do you like the Carl Sagan Cosmos or do you like the Neil deGrasse Tyson Cosmos? And they're on the same theme, but they're not quite in the same ballpark. And
that's right. Are you more turtleneck a la Sagan or are you more vest a la Tyson?
Well, yeah, I was thinking we should do a comparison. Who wore it better? Who wore the astronomy outfits better? Carl Sagan, turtleneck or... Man, that Neil deGrasse Tyson vest. I mean, come on. That's hard to top that.
Nerd
factor, if nothing else. I mean, I couldn't do it. I couldn't pull that off. Turtleneck, maybe I could pull off, but...
But vest? But like embroidered, like space vest with like sun and stars and stuff? I mean, I guess if anybody has an embroidered vest that they'd like to send to Dean, it's 3489 Observatory Place.
No, don't give him that. Don't give him the address. I don't need more vests.
You have that tie, though.
I do have that tie. That's one of my best favorite ties that I have of the planets that somebody gave me. I don't know. Who is better? It's really hard to say. I think each person was like a product of their time. And so I don't know if maybe Carl wouldn't appeal to today's generation as much as Neil does. I don't know. But then I also look at it and say, well, it's pretty timeless, the stuff that he's talking about. And Carl's really charming, like in a very, unusual is
what he's, unique.
There we go. He's very uniquely charming. And then, you know, then Neil is just, you know, he just can, he's just such a good communicator. It just was really, the two of them are the tops, that's for sure.
This is so diplomatic of you, honestly. It's like, you're like, they're both great. Yeah, and I don't want to have to pit the, this is like, this is, you know, women get pit against each other. I'm just going to little soapbox here. Get pit against each other all the time. But you're just like, no, let's not do that. They're just, they're both great. They're both wonderful. Yeah. And that's the lesson here. You don't have to prefer either one. You can just like, also would the plural be cosmi? Like,
cosmi, yeah. Cosmoses.
I was the cosmoses.
Cosmoses. Well, cosmos is everything. So there's only one cosmos, but I guess there's show... There may, maybe there is no plural. We'll have to look that
again,
up.
Again, it's terrifying because it's so big and scary. But it is nice that they can, that, you know, there's the show brings it kind of down to earth, so to speak, or whatever.
Yeah. I always like to say. And I think maybe the original show, what we're seeing, there are a lot of people that were inspired by that today, that, you know, they're coming of age. And you know, the original show with Carl Sagan, is the people that watch that are probably a lot of the same people that, they're working on SpaceX and working at NASA and that type of thing. And you got to think, well, maybe this new generation will be inspired by the new cosmos, and we might have this big boom of scientists and astronauts and things coming from this down the line. But,
well, and there's so many revivals of things. I was just thinking about this, you know, there's, of course we interviewed Beekman from Beekman's World. That was a show when we were, we'll say younger.
Right.
And,
yeah.
You know, I just started watching the original Supermarket Sweep on Netflix.
Yeah, I saw that too.
Which there is a point to me bringing that up, which is that even though the original Cosmos was, you know, in the 80s or in 1980, that it still has, you know, it can be rediscovered by a whole new generation. Although, of course, with Neil deGrasse Tyson working on the show, that's also, but it's kind of nice that these shows are like having little comebacks.
Yeah, and I think rewatching the old series is kind of fun too, because there's a lot of new discoveries that have been made since then. So some of the things are a little quaint and in some cases a little off target with what we know now, but the vast majority of it is kind of timeless. It's taking a big broader look at where we are. And and I know there's that, you know, the picture of the Earth from space is one of those things that just captures people's attention. And I think that was a big inspiration for Carl Sagan too, is that, you know, the Earth is just this tiny little speck in this black cosmic ocean, and it's the only place where we can live. And I think that's part of the whole message, is that we got to take care of this planet we're on too. And I think that comes through both of the series.
That's for sure. So now I have a question for you, Dean.
Okay.
I know you love like talking about like things like this, of course. So let me just ask you, let's say you were going to have like, you're going to be the host of Cosmos, the next generation or whatever. And they're going to have like guests on the show, right? Not just like experts and stuff, but like you could invite anybody on the show you want, living, dead, other, what have you. Who is the person you want to have on the show the very most?
The most I would want. Oh, boy, that's tough. You know, I'm fascinated by astronauts. I know that. I'm very fascinated by them.
A grown man that owns a spacesuit.
Yeah, it's a flight suit, not a full spacesuit. I can never get a.
You're well, right, but the visual is funnier.
if anybody has a spacesuit, please mail it to 3489 Observatory. But I'll take a spacesuit over a Neil deGrasse Tyson vest, please.
Forget the embroidered applique vest.
Yeah. But I would think I would want to talk to as many astronauts as possible. Mm. I think I'm not sure like I could hang out with them and be buds with them, but because they're just like in this ethereal plane. They're like,
we've interviewed several and you've moderately kept your cool.
I know we have, but I remember when we talked to Lauren Worley about that she used to work at NASA, and I asked the question straight out, are astronauts better than us? And she said, absolutely. They are better than us. They're better. They're stronger. They're faster. They're smarter.
Yeah.
They eat better. I mean, they're just... So I would love to talk to any astronauts, and that was really great talking to Scott Kelly, and just the whole, I'm fascinated by the psychology of astronauts and how they can live up in space for that long. And So that would be good. And I, of course, love to talk to astronomers of the past. And, you know, I think out of all the astronomers of the past, Galileo would be the one that I would be able to relate to the most. I think he and I could actually be friends and we could go out for beers and stuff like that.
Yeah. Or like me, all the other or whatever he drank in those times.
Or whatever he drank in Italy.
Sure.
But yeah, I don't think Copernicus and I and Kepler and... Well, Tycho Brahe would be a very interesting one to talk to, that's for sure. He's the Danish nobleman astronomer from the Renaissance that, well, he had a very storied past and had his nose cut off in a duel and died of a burst bladder. I mean, all sorts of fun stuff.
Yeah,
I would love
to
talk to him.
He was a lot.
But I don't think he would like me very much. Whereas me and Galileo, I think we would be...
You think you guys could hang?
I think we would hit it off pretty well. So those would be my two things. I'll talk to talk to Scott Kelly again and Galileo. Those are my top two. What a combo.
Excellent choices. And would those two get along? What if they started talking?
Oh, no.
And
no
then,
way.
Oh, no. Okay, fine.
No, they would not get along whatsoever.
Oh, so you wouldn't be worried about having them together in the studio or whatever.
Oh, yeah. Those would be like two alpha males together. It'd be rough. It'd be rough, the two of them. I would, yeah. But it would be fun, actually.
Would be interesting.
We could do a simulated... astronaut versus Galileo thing.
We need to find a Galileo impersonator stat. There's got to be one. There's a John Adams impersonator. There's got to be a Galileo impersonator somewhere, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we have that volunteer. We won't say our volunteer looks like Galileo. He knows who he is. We don't want to say his name
on
air.
That's right. We'll just leave it.
I could have sworn he could be a Galileo impersonator.
Oh, my God. Well, this is interesting. I did not realize this was going to go, but I'm excited to know it. And maybe, you know, we'll get you a show eventually. You can see if we can make this happen.
Oh, yeah. I'm in the book. Andruyan is an Emmy and Peabody Award winning American writer, producer, and director specializing in the communication of science. She co-wrote the 1980 PBS documentary series Cosmos, hosted by Carl Sagan, whom she married in 1981. She's been a producer on the subsequent Cosmos series, including Cosmos Possible Worlds earlier this year. She also wrote the accompanying book, and we spoke with her just before the pandemic shut everything down. Well, Anne, thanks so much for joining us today. This is a real treat.
My pleasure, Dean. I'm really glad to be talking with you.
Well, so for folks that might not know, how would you describe the Cosmos TV series and books? I mean, it's much more than astronomy, right?
Oh, yes. I mean, astronomy would be enough, but it's much more than that. Cosmos is a synthesis of all the sciences and history and poetry and music and visual effects that I think are comparable to the blockbusters of the movie. So Cosmos is the original series that I wrote with Carl and with Steven Soda was about finding our coordinates in space and time. The new theory is an argument for the future, not only in envisioning a future in which we're not all living in container ships, you know, in shipping containers, and the world hasn't been completely ruined, but a future in which we use our science and high technology with wisdom and foresight, and one which takes us to the stars.
Well, and you've worked, of course, with Carl Sagan and with Neil deGrasse Tyson, two of the best science sort of popularizers of all time. What do you think makes for a really excellent science communicator?
I think the first thing, no matter how learned the person is you have to really have a passion to connect with the audience, with your reader, with the person you're talking to. It should never be an opportunity to show off how much you know. But instead, as Carl used to say, when you're in love, you want to tell the world. You should have that feeling that the revelations of modern science about the universe and about nature are so thrilling, uplifting, life-enhancing that you want to share them with everyone.
Well, and I'm so glad you said it's, you know, astronomy is enough, because it is to me, but that's my bias, I guess. And there's some of the images that come from Cosmos and the view of Earth from billions of miles away, I think, is so moving to a lot of people. The pale blue dot picture, and we just got the latest version from the Cassini spacecraft looking at Earth from beyond the rings of Saturn. Why do you think that pale blue dot image is so powerful to people?
Because it's instantly understandable. You don't need an advanced degree in any scientific field to understand what our true circumstances are as conveyed by that picture. You know, Carl mounted a campaign in NASA from 1981 onwards to get Voyager 1 to take that picture once it had completed its reconnaissance of the outer solar system. And people in NASA and even people on the scientific teams were like, well, what good would it do us? What's the value, the scientific value? But Carl was that rare person who understood that for us to see that tiny one-pixel Earth, not the frame-filling Apollo image, which had such an effect on our civilization, but to go to that next level, to see our true circumstances in the cosmos. You know, anyone seeing that picture, how relatively tiny our world is to understand why the nationalist, the polluter, is a danger to us all. And so, you know, I think all shades, all kinds of fanaticism pale and lose their grip on us when we actually see that picture from high above, out by Neptune, looking down at the plane of the galaxy, to see the family portrait of the sun, the other planets as well, and to grasp how rare and precious this magnificent world is, how worth protecting it is. And so I think that in that image, art, science, philosophy, and spirituality all will come together in that simple image, telling us to cherish and protect that pale blue dot.
So, and maybe you kind of did speak to it a little bit, but what would you say is Carl's legacy? Kind of, he's such a powerful figure in, you know, pop culture, in of course astronomy. What would you say is kind of, or he would want to be his legacy?
I think he would have wanted the world to begin to take the insights of science to heart. The scientists have been remarkable in their prophetic abilities. They saw our current climate change crisis 70 years ago, and they were warning about that. We warned about inadvertent climate modification in the first Cosmos broadcast in 1980. But we don't listen to the scientists. We have a tendency to compartmentalize science and to think it's just, you know, 40 minutes of boredom or terror a few times a week, and that's all it is. But in fact, science has demonstrated not only its ability to see into the future, but also to reconstruct the distant past that we know nothing of without the scientific method. And so I think Carl's, I can't speak for him because he was one of a kind and truly great, but I think he would have wished for the highest possible degree of science literacy for every citizen, so that we can be informed decision makers, so that we can't be so easily manipulated and deceived. I think he would also, purely for the joy of it, for as many people on Earth as possible, to experience that soaring spiritual uplift that comes from knowing even just a tiny bit about the universe and nature.
Well, Anna and I have talked a lot about the golden records that were on the Voyagers, and you know, the sounds of Earth, our greatest hits. How did that project come about to put together a record to send on a spacecraft, and how difficult was it to do?
Frank Drake, the great Frank Drake, and Carl Sagan, two very close friends and colleagues, were asked by NASA to create a message. They had done one with Linda Salzman for the Pioneer mission, but that was essentially a license plate. And they realized that a far more complex and rich message could be sent on both Voyagers. And to my everlasting amazement, Carl asked me to be the creative director of the project. I worked with about half a dozen people, all of whom were trying to create the best possible picture of life on Earth that beautiful spring of 1977. And so we assembled 59 human languages, both languages that are no longer spoken and the languages of the current world. One whale language, the language of the humpback whale, as well as 27 pieces from the world's musical traditions. At that time, there was no concept of world music. American popular music really dominated the airwaves, and people didn't give much thought to the music that was being made in Senegal or in other parts of the world. And it was our privilege to be able to change that with the Voyager record. There's a sound essay, which I made, which was a kind of audio history of the world, as well as an hour's meditation of the brainwaves, heart sounds, every single signal that my body was sending out as I meditated about that history and a little bit about some of the joys of life on Earth. All of that, as well as 118 images of life on Earth, were turned into the sounds of the golden record affixed to Voyagers 1 and 2 that are now the most distant objects ever touched by human hands. And most amazing of all is that they have a projected shelf life of 1 to 5 billion years. They will be moving through the Milky Way galaxy, making some 8 circumnavigations of the whole galaxy before they degrade and can no longer be interpreted.
Wow, and they're out there in the, among the stars. And, of course, I love having Johnny B. Goode on that record. That's my great addition. What do you think that, what should we expect from the latest version of Cosmos that's coming out, the TV series, and, of course, your book, too?
I hope that you'll find a really inspiring vision of a great future. The one that we can still have. We are all descended from tens of thousands of generations of humans who had their backs to the wall and managed somehow to endure. And I believe that we have what it takes at this moment of very low human self-esteem. We have to remember who we come from and what's in our DNA and how we can rise to meet these challenges and really have a vision of not only the near future, it will take you to the 2039 New York World Fair, but also the distant future when perhaps humans are arrayed throughout the galaxy on many different possible worlds.
Well, I think the main thing with Cosmos is just such a positive vision of the future, and we look forward to this, and your book is amazing. We thank you so much for your time today.
I'm honored to be with you. Thank you so much for these great questions and for the delight of this conversation.
We were so very grateful to Anne for taking the time to join us here on Looking Up.
Well, just because we're not in the office doesn't mean we can't still get crank file questions. Thank God for social media making that possible. So we're going to do a special quarantine crank file for everyone's listening pleasure today. Because we've been getting, well, we got, specifically, I'll let Dean explain. We got some videos from a very bored, very determined person, we will say, on our Facebook. And they did not take, well, why don't you explain what happened, Dean?
Yeah.
And how you expertly handled it.
Oh, thank you. I don't know if that's quite the case, but
yeah, I was sort of being generous.
So, yeah, during the quarantine, well, people have had some free time on their hands. So they've gotten out their cameras and their phones and taken pictures of the sky. So we've gotten our fair share of blurry UFO pictures and things of Venus. When Venus was in the sky, they were getting a lot of Venus pictures. And so every couple weeks I get some of these that, well, I have to respond to and tell people what they are. And so we got one not too long ago about a video taken on the moon. So he attached his phone to or a camera to a scope and was taking some video of the moon, which is really pretty cool to do, by the way. You can do this with your camera, your phone, really. If you have it on a tripod, you can video the moon, especially the new phones. You can like zoom all in. So he was taking some pictures and sent me a video of it and said, "What do you think of this?" And I wrote back. I said, "Cool. Good job. Yeah, it looks good." And then he said, "No."
Some people just need head pats, Dean. They just need
I was really hoping that was going to be the end of it, that he just wanted me to validate and say, "Great video."
Mm-hmm.
But no, there was something on the video that I needed to see. And so what it was he was doing some Photoshopping and some adjusting of the contrast. So he's bringing the contrast way, way, way up, like to the very extreme. And when you do that, you kind of, the image gets to this breaking point where it just has all these glitches to it. And so there was this glitch that was appearing on the moon that was flashing. And so he said, "What is that?" And I said, "That's your camera messing up." I said, "This is what happens when you try to Photoshop stuff, and it's like your camera is struggling to try to get a clear picture, but it can't do it because it's beyond its capability." And so that's when he maybe the not so nice email started from him saying,
"They were just indignant or insistent indignant or something.
What that the nerve of you to say that it's the camera? It's obviously." Well, that's the thing is that he didn't say, you know, he just didn't like my answer. So this is what we see with the crank file. And I do like to think of our old astronomers from the 1800s and the early 1900s just getting these like letters from people asking them for questions. And then they write back and say, "No, it's really something else." And I wonder if they ever take the time to write back and say, "No, you're wrong, expert."
And it takes longer to write a letter like in the olden days than it would just to type a reply in an email. So
it was very easy. So it's very easy to reply virtually in a very aggressive way. And so he sent me some links to other things of people saying that they're seeing flashes on the moon. And here's a video of flashes on the moon and that there are mysterious lights on the moon that happen. And so I wrote back. I said, "No, it's your camera. It's your camera." So he didn't like that so much. So then he wrote back and said, "My camera's perfect. Goodbye." And so that was it. Actually,
he showed
one,
you.
Yeah, he showed me. Boy, he showed me the. I wanted to write back and say, "Wait, you wrote to me?
Yeah,
you asked me first. I'm just giving you my answer." And I did. There was one intermediary one where I wrote. I said, "You know, because he said you got it all figured out, don't you?" That's what he said.
Oh.
And so I said, "No, I don't have it all figured out. This is my opinion. I wasn't there like you were. What do you think it was?"
I love when you flip it back on people and then they tell you some like nonsensical thing and you're like, no, I'm kidding. It's like, do you really think it is? You have no idea. That's why you're asking.
Unfortunately, he did not answer that question. And so he never told me what it was in his mind, but whatever I said it was not what it was.
Clearly
so,
not.
So I don't think I made a friend out of this one. I'm sorry, Anna. I tried. I did my best to be as diplomatic, but
maybe next time.
they don't always end in happy endings, but he did say goodbye. And so that,
yeah, I don't think that was really like a courtesy. I think it was like a tell off.
Yes. And unfortunately he didn't mean it, because a few days later, he sent me another video of another
I forgot about
UFO like thing, alien thing.
Oh.
And, I'm sorry. I didn't. Oh, wait. No, I did respond. I responded. I said, cool video.
You did. You straight, like with like an exclamation point. I was like, wow.
Cool video. But he didn't ask anymore. So that's what I tried to do in the first one when he sent me the video. I was like, cool video. But no, that wasn't enough.
Clearly not.
The cycle repeats itself. Crank file. Cool video. And then, oh, it just keeps going.
But, you know, isn't it good to know in this time of uncertainty and unprecedented change that some things remain the same, and that is the crank file will always be.
That's exactly.
That's comforting in some weird way.
It is. Somewhere in this universe, there are still cranks out there, right. And crank file will continue to live you. On. They will find me. Oh, please don't find me anymore.
Again, 3489.
No, not the, no, don't give me the address.
Well, that's it for this episode of Looking Up. Thanks very much to Andrew Ian for joining us.
Now that we're back, we'd love to hear from you and your ideas for show topics and guests. Email us at lookingup@wvxu.org.
The archives of all past episodes of Looking Up is easy to find. Check them all out at wvxu.org/lookingup.
Wherever you get your podcasts, you'll find us there. If that happens to be Apple Podcasts, your rating and comments will help others find us. So, thanks for helping us out. And if you like what you hear, spread the word.
Our theme song and additional music is by Y, that's W-H-Y ? From their album Moline, courtesy of Joyful Noise Recordings and Terror Bird Media.
Looking Up is a production of Cincinnati Public Radio. Kevin Reynolds is our producer, Josh Elstro is our engineer, and Jim Nolan provides additional technical assistance.
Thanks so much for listening. I'm Anna Heeman.
And I'm Dean Regas. Keep looking up.